Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Spicer, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, artist for Smugby Games and Game Wisdom site designer, Kenneth Olm.
Hey.
And our special guest this week, she is an adventure game designer and writer who has been a part of the industry now for over 20 years, and who is recently working on her latest game, Mobius, from Pinkerton Road Studio, Jane Jensen.
Hey, nice to be here.
Nice to meet you, Jane.
You too.
And it's pretty great to talk to you. As I just said, you've been doing this since, I believe, the 90s, right, with the Gabriel Knight games?
Yeah, the first Gabriel Knight game came out in 1993, and I started at Sierra a couple years before that.
Cool. And it's great to talk to someone who has been in the industry for so long. We've been speaking to designers who basically got started over the last decade, and as we talk to them, it's so interesting to see how far the industry has come in 10 years, much less 20 years, because I remember growing up back then, it's just insane to see how far we've come over the last two decades.
Right. I mean, development costs has gone down, and smaller teams can do a lot bigger projects. And
yeah, the whole indie takeoff is interesting. Indie and the Kickstarter stuff, I think, is really having a big impact.
Yeah.
Who introduced you to Kickstarter, by the way? The idea.
Well, interestingly enough, my husband and his band used it to kickstart a CD a couple years before we did it for our games. Mm-hmm. So I was familiar with the idea.
Cool. Yep, and we're going to talk a bit more about Kickstarter and how Mobius came along in a little bit. So to begin with, Jane, for people who may not be too familiar with you and the adventure game genre, could you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about the games you like to make?
Yeah, my education was in computer science, and I was working on mainframes at Hewlett-Packard when I got my very first PC, which was about 1989, and I discovered Sierra Games, King's Quest IV and Manhunter San Francisco, and I just fell in love with them. And at the time, I was working as an engineer and writing a novel in my spare time. I really wanted to be a writer eventually, and I just saw a great synergy of those two interests in game design. So I ended up applying to Sierra and was able to go work for them. So I was with Sierra Online as my first game design job. Worked on Police Quest 3, King's Quest 6, and then got a chance to do my own series, which was Gabriel Knight. I did three of them for Sierra and left there in 1999. Co-founded a company called Oberon Media, which did casual games. I was there for about 7 years. We did a lot of the early hidden object games, and specifically pushing them more towards adventure. And then ended up kickstarting our own studio to do adventure games again in 2012.
Cool.
It's quite a rich history. So just a quick question about the Gabriel Knight series. All the art styles were extremely varied from what I was looking at, and I was wondering, was that because you guys were basing your design on technology, or because you thought that would be a better aesthetic?
It was always sort of the company decision, you know, because, I mean, if they were going to spend $1 million on a game, they wanted it to, by the time it came out, to be cutting edge and not be based on old technology. So we always had to work with where, you know, Ken thought the industry was heading.
Yeah, I remember. I think we talked about this on a previous cast. I remember when, like, the live action was going to be the next big thing with the Sewer Shark games, Tom Vito Studios, and then that sort of quieted down, and then 3D came on.
Yep.
And now, look where we are now. It's insane.
Yeah, some of the high-end games are just unbelievable.
What of the three games, what do you think stands out the best, at least to the test of time?
Of the three Gabriel Knight games?
Yes.
I think probably GK2 is the favorite game because of the story and the sort of eroticism of that game, I think. And so that seems to be the fan favorite.
Okay. Now, one question I have for you regarding adventure game design. Since you're both a designer and a writer, where is your philosophy start from when you're designing an adventure game? Do you start thinking about in terms of puzzles and the gameplay, or do you think more in terms of the plot and essentially what the narrative of the game is going to be?
I always start with story. Like on Mobius, the first thing I did was write the story outline, which was about 125 pages, and that went through the plot, chapter by chapter of what, I mean, really in detail. And I'll even write dialogue sometimes at that stage if it's in my head, as I'm going. But I've been designing for a long time, so I kind of know when I'm doing the story what makes sense for a game and what doesn't. You know, like I wouldn't put, you know, and then they go to outer space and, you know, spend 10 years and, you know, and, you know. So, you know, it's in my head. And sometimes if I'm actually, you know, seeing a puzzle somewhere, I'll jot that down. But the narrative is definitely for, you know, the characters, the character arc, the story flow, the plot line. That's always first.
Okay. Now, speaking about puzzle design, this is, of course, another major point when it comes to adventure game design. We've seen puzzles, you know, we've seen very simple ones. We've seen some that have caused people to go nuts over. I know Gabriel Knight, I think, is one that's famously mentioned for, like, the cat mustache puzzle.
Yeah.
So how do you approach puzzle design, then, in terms of keeping that with the logic of your own narrative?
Well, one of the reasons why I usually work with a mystery thriller plot line is because I really do like to integrate the puzzles very, very much into the story. Like, you wouldn't see it just like a roulette puzzle or something, you know, for no apparent reason. So, you know, using a mystery thriller plot line, usually that, I mean, what you do in the story is you uncover clues, you talk to people, you know, search an area, you know, analyze something. So those things are story points that make good puzzles. And I just try to keep it very tightly interwoven.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I grew up on Sierra and LucasArts. Well, I didn't grow up, but the first games that I really loved were the Sierra and the LucasArts adventure games. So I still have a real fondness for things like inventory puzzles and, you know, little arcade sequences and, you know, the occasional death and, you know, some of that stuff. Although having worked in casual games for 7 years, it's certainly changed my approach. But,
yeah, definitely. We've seen the adventure genre really shifted over the last decade. There's that period that a lot of people call sort of like the decline of the genre, then started to come back, like right around the time Telltale started to become big and popular.
Yeah, they've done a great service for the adventure game over the last, I don't know how many years, 6 years, eight years in putting them out. Yeah.
Yep. And I will ask you a little bit more about that in a second. Going back to the adventure genre as a whole, I was wondering, besides the Gabriel Knight games, are there any other adventure games that you enjoyed or essentially inspired you when you were designing your own?
Well, when I was designing the early Gabriel Knight stuff, you know, I was inspired again by some of the Sierra games, like King's Quest and Lorabeau and LucasArts stuff like Monkey Island. And I think the first Indiana Jones just came out right around the time that the first Gabriel Knight did. But yeah, those were my early influences. I mean, more recently, you know, I really do like things like Heavy Rain and Walking Dead and just those more narrative, flowy type games.
Yep. It's interesting that you mentioned the narrative flow type games. As you just said a few minutes ago, you enjoy, like, the mystery or, like, the classic design of, you know, inventories, challenging puzzles. So now that, you know, years have gone by, we've sort of moved to more of a casual or more of a narrative focus. Do you still enjoy playing, like, the older adventure games or that older style? Or do you prefer this newer, more narrative-focused style?
I really like them both, you know. It's like apples and oranges to me.
Okay.
You know, in terms of what I'm, you know, with Mobius, we really tried to sort of include both types of things. You know, we are doing some more classic inventory-based puzzles and things like that. First-person puzzles, some which are almost even more casual game-based. And then also, you know, narrative choice based stuff. I think the key is just to, I mean, see, the thing is, like, I really love puzzles because, I mean, I love all kinds of puzzles. I love jigsaw puzzles. I love, you know, Tetris. I love, you know, my dad was a mathematician, and that's just a side of my brain that I really enjoy that kind of thing. So it would probably, you know, be difficult for me to design a game where there wasn't any puzzles. You know, it was all narrative flow. But we are trying to combine that in a more gentle way, I guess, Mobius.
Yep.
Please do, because sometimes I go back to those old adventure games, and when I get stuck, I have to just rely on a walkthrough to finish the rest of the game, pretty much, because some of those puzzles are so far out on my logic range.
Yeah, yeah. Some of them were really hard.
Now, speaking about puzzle design, what's your, like, general philosophy for a good puzzle, or what do you feel makes a good adventure game puzzle versus one that doesn't quite work.
I just always have a compulsion to, like, nest stuff. Like, if it's too straightforward, if, like, you know, X and Y equals Z, you know, that's, like, too straightforward. It has to be X and Y, but you have to get Y over it, you know? I mean, I always like to have levels of, you know, abstraction. To me, that makes it a lot more satisfying to solve something. Like, you know, hey, what can I use here? Well, I noticed this thing way back, you know, I mean, I just like that sort of, trying to induce that aha moment, I guess.
Yeah, and that's sort of what we saw a lot with the older Avenger game series, trying to, essentially, we call, you know, MacGyvering your way through the situation.
But it doesn't, not necessarily that it has to be, you know, some unlikely object that you use somewhere, just more that, you know, there's more depths of level to the puzzle than just, you know, it being very straightforward on the surface.
Yeah. So, yep, go ahead.
I'll ask you this question. How did you come up with the idea for, what would you call it, Dr. Cat Mustache puzzle?
Yeah, that was the Gabriel, I think that was Gabriel Knight 1 from what people were talking about.
No, it was GK3.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, that felt like it was DK, yeah, the GK3.
I think the basis of that puzzle was that Gabriel was trying to rent a moped, and he had to use Mosley's driver's license, and so he had to make himself look like the picture on the driver's license. So he had to make a mustache, basically, and you made the mustache from cat hair and something else, something sticky. I can't remember what it was. You know, it was kind of funny because I don't know why that particular puzzle got so famous. I mean, there's just like hundreds of examples like that in adventure games, but yeah, it made sense at the time, I guess.
Oh, okay, so there's like a big story behind it. It was just an interesting puzzle idea at the time.
We had a friend on a few months ago, and we were talking about our favorite adventure games or the ones that cause us the most grief, and he just had like horrific nightmares of trying to solve that one puzzle.
He went to the detail of his strain for it too.
Oh no!
And he's all like, "Why can't I just ask the guy? Because it's like, why can't I just ask my friend for an ID? He probably would have done it."
Now, going back to what you said a few minutes ago regarding focusing more on the story first and then design the gameplay, are there any like interesting pacing challenges when you're trying to tell the story, but at the same time you're introducing these roadblocks in the form of the puzzles?
I don't really see them as roadblocks. I mean, you know, to me, it's just, you know, I mean, the feeling that I'm trying to induce in the player is that I am this, you know, I am this character, and I'm trying to solve this, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to solve this thing, and I need to, you know, oh, here's a clue, and, you know, just make it more feel like you are the ego. I mean, if everything's just given to you without any interactivity, then, you know, you might as well be reading a book, right?
Yeah.
So when you actually write the story, and let's say you break adventure games down to, like, rooms, do you actually write all the, do you also write all the dialogue while the inspections also separately, or do you keep that in mind while you're writing your outline?
Well, usually there's a the story outline first, and then that has to get moved into a game design. And that's the most challenging part, because, you know, that's when you're trying to take a pure narrative and introduce it, you know, break it into interactivity and puzzles and all that. And then we usually do, like, room descriptions, which is, you know, like, for the bookshop in Gabriel Knight, all the things, you know, it's a doc just for that room, like, all the things that ever happened there through the whole course of the game, so that the artists know what has to be in that room, and then scripting phase, and then, you know, during scripting phase is when you write all the, you know, the main dialogue and all the incidental look messages and things like that. So what was your question specifically about those kinds of messages?
No, I'm just interested because it seems like I have a daunting task for anyone that wants to get into creating adventure games themselves, because logically you'd say, like, all right, I'm going to write the story, they're going to make some puzzles, and then but then you realize that there's a huge amount of content you're going to have to create also, because as soon as you, you know, or start, as soon as you, especially if you do inspections and stuff like that, like, it's all their internal thoughts, and you have to factor in when they're going to do it and how they're going to do it, what object they could they interact with the other one through their inventory, and just a lot of stuff to kind of factor in. So just, I was just pretty much wondering how the process
is. It's very logic intensive. I mean, you know, like I said, my education was in computer programming, so I have sort of a logical mind anyway, but I mean, it was really, really helpful because there's a, you know, game design is all if then, you know, kind of structures and thinking about what state the player might be in, and, you know, sort of like programming with fiction, really.
Right. It's conditional mania.
Yeah. Now, another question about the older Avenger game design logic. One thing that I've always wondered is, Where did, like, the idea that comes behind having a score for an adventure game came from? A few months ago, I decided to try to go back and play a lot of the older adventure games, the King's Quest, and those types of games, and as someone who never grew up playing those games, I kind of found it weird that you had a score measure how well you solved puzzles or what you did in the world.
Well, you know, that was just tradition at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the Gabriel Knight games had it, and actually we have a score in Mobius as well, and, mm-hmm. and it's, for me, it's not so much... It's more of a progress bar, you know, it's more of a bookmark, like, mm-hmm. I'm halfway through, you know, there's 600 points and I've got 289, so I'm almost halfway through the game, you know, it's more a measure of, and then, of course, you know, if you have stuff in there, you know, there's always, it's also for the sort of the OCD people who mm-hmm. are like, you know, I want to make sure I saw every single thing in this game, and, you know, those sorts of point lists are a way to give those people something to... Mm-hmm. You know, make sure that they saw everything. If you have optional stuff, mm-hmm. then it's just a way to sort of show when you are 100% complete, I guess.
Okay.
Sounds like to me it would kind of take the player out because it's a role-playing game, right? So you don't want to keep them kind of immersed. But when you see a score, it kind of like makes a disconnect, wouldn't it?
Well, it depends on how distracting it is, I mm-hmm. guess. Like in Mobius, it's up on this little thing that you can slide out that, you know, it's not like sirens go off or something at the point, but I think you want to keep it as immersive as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as long as it's not like a giant UI element, like it's like right in the bottom, right in the center, it's like score 10. Okay, I did it.
Now, as you said, you've been moving along with the adventure genre. You moved to casual games for a little bit. Now you're back to it. Over the years, are there any mechanics or design of the adventure genre that you feel that you've either outgrown yourself or that the genre itself has sort of moved away from or no longer needs to use?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, you know, and it's sort of interesting because really, like I was saying, that GK2 is one of our most popular, mm-hmm. it's one of my most popular games. And the design philosophy that we use on GK2, I think, is actually very similar to what we're doing with Mobius, and it's very more modern in that, mm-hmm. you know, in that game, it wasn't about having individual puzzles be hard. It was more about keeping people's minds engaged with questions about the story. Like, well, why did he say that? What did that mean? Mm-hmm. Well, I have to go back to the zoo because, you know, he said that there might be, you know, it's like, you want to keep the person's mind engaged with stories and not so much like, you know, a puzzle that, mm-hmm. like you said, I mean, a very roadblocky kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, those sorts of roadblocky things like pixel hunting, you know, the really early Sierra games, like when I played King's Quest IV, mm-hmm. you know, I probably searched for 6 hours for like something that ended up being, you know, ring ended mm-hmm. up being like one pixel of gold on a beige bed of sand or something, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff is, there's just not really any purpose for that anymore. And in fact, we have, you know, all of our current games have, you know, you hit space bar and you see the hotspots. Mm-hmm. And we did that in Grey Matter as well. You know, not basically that sense that, you know, I can't end this day, I can't end this chapter because there's something I haven't done yet and I have to go back and, you know, recheck these 20 rooms to try to figure out what it is I missed. You know, that sort of thing is just, you know, I don't think the modern audience has the patience for that. And mm-hmm. there's just no reason for it. And, you know, another sort of big game that was really, really popular at the time was Myst, and I just mm-hmm. found the puzzles in Myst so incredibly hard. I mean, yeah. I don't think I ever actually solved one of those without. Mm-hmm. It's like, why? You know, it's just no. I just don't see a reason for things to be that difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I talked about this on a previous cast when I tried to play Yuru, which I think won the last Myst games. I just had to use their hint guide. Like they gave you like these incremental hints. You know, a very general and the specific one. I just went, you know what? Screw that. Just tell me the answer. I can't do this. These hints aren't doing it for me.
Yeah, so, I mean, just that level of difficulty, I just don't think there's a mm-hmm. point to it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Don't worry, they gave you a cool journal, though, that came with the game.
The game was beautiful, you know, and like, it was, I mean, everyone bought it because it looked so great, but it was like, how many people actually finished that game, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
And probably, like, the ultimate irony for all those puzzles is that if you look at the strategy guide, you can actually beat the entire game in, like, 10 minutes just by circumventing all the puzzles and all the solutions.
Well, actually, there's a quicker one. It's like at the very, very beginning, you can mm-hmm. solve the whole thing within a second, actually. It's one of those puzzles. Because eventually, all the puzzles bring you all the way back to where you originally started. And you're like, that's oh, right. this little post. Mm-hmm. Oh, I could have just finished the game like when I started. Okay. But let's see. I was going to say something about puzzle design, too, but I forgot. So,
now, as you said, speaking about the modern gamer, One of the things that sort of took root over the last decade and has like died down a little bit has been QTE, or QuickTime Event Action Sequences. We saw this sort of become adopted in a lot of the adventure games of the thousands. We even saw this in games like The Walking Dead and The Wolf Among Us. I was just wondering, Jane, what are your thoughts on those types of mechanics? Because they seem to be another very polarizing topic among both action fans and adventure game fans.
Well, I know that when we, you know, we put stuff like that in our games and we get people play. I mean, I love that little thing. I mean, you know, a lot of the early Sierra games, King's Quest, would have these little arcade sequences, like hopping across rocks, you know, to cross a thing or whatever. And I always found it just a nice change of pace. But, like, we have a first-person puzzle in Mobius where you have to climb something and you can die. And, you know, there's a reset on it. It doesn't, like, it just resets you to the beginning of the puzzle. So you don't have to have a save game or anything. But, you know, our beta testers really didn't like it. So, yeah, I think, you know, for our audience, we, you know, we probably need to not do a ton of that.
Did you play Fahrenheit/Indigo Prophecy?
I played some of Indigo Prophecy, but not just like the first chapter or so.
Oh, too bad, because there's actually an infamous area, too, where they really change it up in terms of pacing. And there's this area where this character has to go through this really tight corridor. She's claustrophobic. And so you have to, like, look for something while, like, pressing the left and right directional keys to make sure that you don't hyperventilate. And I feel like that's one of the weakest parts of the game because it was such a big, drastic change. But yeah. I do also understand the concept that it's also good to kind of shake it up in terms of pacing. So how do you feel about, like, that kind of, like, I would say extreme change to kind of invigorate the pacing of the story?
Well, I mean, you know, I think we are doing it somewhat where, you know, you have a short period of time to respond to something just because it should, you know, if something is life-threatening, it should be life-threatening, you know, and should be tense. But, you know, I think you have to be... It sounds like that example, you know, didn't go over well because it was too long or it was too hard or whatever. I think you just have to be careful not to, you know, overdo it.
Right.
Now, speak about having death in your game. This is another one of the things that I've heard a lot of people sort of, I guess, argue about. Because I remember playing, like, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where every puzzle you could basically die from if you didn't click the right thing or use the right item. And we also saw this a lot in older adventure games like the King's Quest series. And this is one of the things that has also sort of died down. I mean, in the Telltale games, while you can die, it's, as you just said, it's essentially just a reset. You die, you get back to the start of the puzzle. Do you think that is sort of like a happy medium between trying to give these events some weight to them and just, you know, outright saying, oh, you're dead, start the game back at zero again?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, there's a number of places in Mobius where you can either die or just screw up so badly that, you know, you can't continue. And so we have a death screen, basically. It's like you know, disrupted the pattern, which is sort of the whole theme of Mobius. But, you know, there's got to come a point. I mean, if there's never any repercussion, you know, then there's not, it doesn't feel realistic. I mean, there's certain situations that, you know, you can get. I mean, if you have 5 seconds to fire a gun and you don't do it, then there should be some kind of repercussion there. The only thing we're trying to avoid is that situation where you don't have a save game and you have to replay, you know, for an hour or something. I mean, nobody likes that. It's just annoying. So, yeah, I think so. I mean, I like the death stuff. So, as long as it doesn't cause a lot of frustration in replay, then I don't see a problem with it.
And I think that is a good point. When I'm playing, like, The Walking Dead and a lot of games from Telltale, they have somewhat moved back from the older adventure game genre design. It's, as we said, it's more narrative-based. But even then, there's not really a lot of weight to your actions in terms of gameplay. They've been moving more towards, like, the choose-your-own-adventure style, or at least partially. And, like, you can't completely change a story, but you can sort of move and edge into certain directions.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, and I haven't had, I mean, I've sort of played through on a single thread, and I haven't had a chance to go back and really examine, like, other paths and other trails and things like that to figure out all, like, how much there is a divergence. But, I mean, to me, what interests me about that is really having a narrative, like, a narrative choice. So, in Mobius, for example, there's a chapter where there are really three whole different paths through that chapter, and you can get to the end, you know. And, but that, you know, that choice was really important to me because there's a moment at which the main character has to decide, either he's going to help somebody or he's not going to help somebody. And it's, you know, to me, that it's sort of like the whole point of his fate is this is like a, you know, a really, really significant moment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we had forced the player to make the help choice, you know, if we just had that be automatic, then it, to me, it would have just really destroyed the value of being this character, you know, and making important decisions as this character. And so, yeah, I mean, I think when, you know, when it really serves a narrative, it's a great thing to do. You know, if it's just, I don't know.
Well, I feel like that's what made The Walking Dead so good is the great decisions you have to make, because you could go one way or another, or you have to kind of just factor in all your experiences with that person. Say you need help somebody, you have to kind of think about that, and it all culminates. And I think it works better for the narrative too.
Yeah, it works really well in that game.
I think I have one more question for you, Jane, about adventure game design, then we'll move on and talk about Kickstarter. I was wondering, what is your thought on the sort of the episodic movement that has happened with the adventure genre? Telltale really started this push towards, instead of delivering one game, they deliver four or five smaller games spread across, it could be 5 months, a year, whatever. And we've seen another interesting debate about whether or not the games are helped or harmed by this sort of compartmentalized type design.
Well, we considered doing Mobius episodic at one point, but we got a lot of negative feedback on that from our Kickstarter backers and from our PR person and, you know, biz dev, and it's tough. I mean, I think even Telltale sees a lot of drop off, you know, after the first episode, and you know, it's kind of tough to get the press, especially when you're a new studio, reinterested every single time there's a new episode. And so we decided to just go with a straight release, but personally, as a player, I don't really have a problem with it as long as they come out, you know, quickly, but I'm just as likely to just wait then and, you know, play the whole thing when it's done.
Yeah, I'm starting to feel that way too. When I first played The Walking Dead, I basically played every episode the minute it came out, finish it that sitting. But with The Walking Dead 2, I'm taking more like the wait approach. I played the first one, I haven't played the second one yet. I think I'm just going to wait for all 5 or 6 episodes to come out and then, you know, have one just binge night of playing it all.
Yeah, I mean, I like to watch TV that way, too. You know, I've just been started watching Teen Wolf, you know, and I've never seen that before, but it's nice to have the whole season right there.
Yeah.
I find it, two things. One, I also find it agonizing, because I really am, like, just consuming these episodes way too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm waiting for the release, and they're not very good with their release dates. They sometimes they push it back a month, but they don't tell you you're pushing back. And, you know, after, like, you know, more than 2 months, people just lose interest, and they just don't want... They just, you know, they just kind of gave up on the franchise for a little bit.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big danger when you come with episodic games.
Yeah.
And second, Teen Wolf, what? that's like, to me, Werewolf Twilight on television.
I just heard a lot about it. I wanted to try it out.
Don't worry, I watched a little bit of it too.
Don't tell anybody.
My credibility. Ugh.
I haven't watched it yet, so I'm still cool.
CBS and...
Well, there's a lot of supernatural shows that exist now.
Mm-hmm.
So, there you go. Supernatural teen fantasies. Yeah. Now its own genre. You go to the bookstore.
And one last point I just want to talk about in terms of game design. I think it's interesting, when I spoke with Dave Gilbert a few weeks ago from Watch It, I know you haven't played his games yet, Jane. He goes for more like the older style. He features like a lot of the pixel art, the 2D type design. And one of the things he said was he made his series, the one he's most famous for, the Blackwell series, Blackwell Chronicles. While they are considered episodic in the sense that he's got 5 parts to them, he designed them each to essentially be a self-contained story into this greater narrative. And I think he found a way to sort of have that happy medium. Each game is complete in that sense that it tells a story, it moves the plot along, and then it ends. But it's not like something like The Walking Dead or Telltale, where every one of the episodes ends with, you know, to be continued, or, you know, these answers will be solved next time. And I think that sort of is that way of keeping the fans happy. Like, they're getting a conclusion, they don't have to wait 5-6 months for part 2 to come out, or if it gets delayed or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is, I tend to write big stories, so it would probably be challenging for me to stick to a structure like that, but it's a good idea.
Well, I think it's also because he didn't call them episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Just give them names, so it didn't feel like episodic gameplay.
Yeah.
But the only thing that makes it's annoying for me when I'm sharing, like I try to get as many people as possible to play the Black Wolf series. I always bring it up. I always try to make them play it. And their naming convention gives no rhyme or reason of what order it is. So they're like, all right, it's Legacy. Then it's Unbound. Then it's Convergence. Then it's...
That's the negative of that.
Yeah, right.
All right.
So before we move on to talk more about Kickstarter and Mobius, Ken, do you have any more adventure game-related questions for Jane?
Sure. When it comes to, for all the budding developers out there that want to get into the genre, what would you say was one of the greatest pitfalls for newbies that are trying to do this field?
I think, you know, try not to be, not to write reams and reams of dialogue, like topic-related dialogue. I've noticed that on a few, like, fan-based games that I've looked at, it's just like, it just goes on and on and on, and it's so bad, and, you know, just making things too difficult.
I see.
Do you suggest that people should design the or write the narrative first and then focus on the game design, or vice versa, or does it not even matter? It could just be any way that you prefer.
I think it depends on the designer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just really, really heavily story-focused, so somebody else might, you know, I mean, the way Roberta liked to design was just sit down with a big pad and just, like, draw circles for rooms and, you know, just really stay high level with it, and... that works well for people. For some people who are, you know, it's more about a world and exploring, and the story is a lighter element to it.
Right. And, like, I think a lot of developers out there have to kind of reel themselves in, what you said earlier, kind of factor in their limitations while they're writing their story, per se, and also factor in their design. I think that's pretty important, because you can't just make some fantastical, like, all right, we have this Cthulhu wild wasteland full of unimaginable, undescribable gods. All right, go. Make it.
Yeah.
So I think with that, let's move on and talk a little bit about Mobius and your Kickstarter. Because as you mentioned at the beginning, Kickstarter has really become this very new force. It's been very helpful for the indie community to get their games out. So my first question for you, Jane, you sort of talked about this at the start, but when the idea for Mobius, was that given birth after Kickstarter, or did you have the idea sort of bouncing around your head and Kickstarter was sort of like the catalyst to get that going?
It was really the latter. It was a concept that I had come up with, you know, a few months prior, and I knew I wanted to do something with it at some point. And then when we did the Kickstarter, which I would never ever do it this way again, but we had this brilliant idea that we would basically kickstart our new studio, and we would let our backers choose which would be the new game that we would make. And we had three options. It was like Grey Matter 2, Mobius, and then there was a sort of a Regency rom-com lighter adventure game. And Mobius was the one that they picked from those. But yeah, it was a lot of confusion around that, but that's how Mobius came to be.
Okay. Will there still be a rom-com in the future?
I would love to do that game at some point, but, you know, there's just so many things that are probably in front of it. Who knows?
I don't know. I don't see that many good rom-com adventure games.
No, there really aren't.
There's some that try, and man, do they fail so hard. It puts me in tears. But go ahead.
Now, with the Kickstarter campaign, there's something else that has sort of evolved over the... I guess it's been, like, just about over 2 years since it really took off. And you said that you had some trouble with the Kickstarter itself. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
I just, you know, our initial approach, I think, was a little too overly complex and confusing. You know, if we were going to do another one, we would just be like, here's the game, you know, here's the you know, concept art, here's a little demo. I mean, we would be much more focused, I think.
Yeah, it's become almost an art form in a sense to try to set up a good Kickstarter campaign. Because we've seen just so many Kickstarters over the last 2 years. Ken has pledged more towards, I think you said, like, technology. I know you also did a Longest Journey Kickstarter.
Oh, man, I love Longest Journey. And I also love Dreamfall. Mm-hmm. So I threw the highest amount possible at those guys.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. I love those games, too.
Yeah, to me, the reason I love Longest Journey so much is because she was April Ryan, the main character, was the first strong female protagonist I ever encountered in my gaming experience. Just a normal person in a peculiar situation. Nothing to exaggerate, because at the time, you know, most women in games were just objectified or sexualized. But this was just an art student trying to make her way. That's why I loved it.
Yeah, it was it's a nice chain for sure.
Mm-hmm. And for me, I generally tend to pledge towards games with interesting design, or they're trying to go for like a modern take on a classic game genre or game mechanic. So the last one that I did was The Darkest Dungeon, which was an attempt at basically a modern, old-school dungeon crawl, you know, roguelike RPG. You know, your party can die and go nuts, and generally bad things happen when you go adventuring in that game.
It seems to be becoming much more standardized or commercialized. I was noticing the other day I was on some website, and I had banner ads,
mm-hmm.
and they were all for, like, you know, this game on Kickstarter now, and it was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are failing, you know, too, so it's mm-hmm. you know, definitely getting much more, you know, people are not,
mm-hmm.
it's like people are getting much pickier about what they want to back, and, you mm-hmm. know, the successful projects are becoming more commercial.
Yeah. Especially with early access and what Steam has done with that, it has become a lot, I guess, harder to pick out the gems from the crap out there. And as you said, there's a lot more, I guess, commercialization with Kickstarter and early access these days, especially when we're seeing projects asking for, you know, millions of dollars. And, of course, there was last week's big Oculus Rift buyout, which people are still talking about, and we still know what the fate and the blowback of that's going to be.
Wow, yeah.
The couple of things I want to say about that. First, about that Oculus Rift buyout.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did complete what they were going to do or say. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have any sort of extra things they had to do for the backers. They gave everyone the developer's kit. That was all they promised. So
mm-hmm.
they can sell out if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a different conversation entirely. But with the Kickstarter and what was the other thing you talked about?
Greenlight? Commercial. Yeah, Greenlight.
No, Greenlight. Actually, Dark Matter, I mean, it's Gray Matter, right? Sorry.
Gray Matter, yeah.
It's not on Steam.
I think it just came on Steam, I think.
It was approved for Steam.
I think I just saw it release. I think I just saw it on the store page today, just before I came onto the cast. Cool. Yeah.
Did it? Yeah. Well, I've been trying to greenlight that, actually. I've been following it, and it looked really great. I really love the premise, so
mm-hmm.
I was like, where is it? I can't find it. I'm like, oh, I have to greenlight it and hope for the best. So I'm glad it's on the store now. That's yeah. amazing. I need to. Actually, this is a little off, because this is, everyone knows the cast, they know how much I love Steam cards.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to create Steam cards for your new game?
You mean like the achievement card things?
Yeah.
Yeah, the things that you can sell and upgrade your profiles.
I know we have done Steam achievements, and I think we did do cards.
I promise you it'll help, because people, it doesn't matter what your game is, as long as you have cards, people will just buy it blindly. But cards, yes.
Okay.
But obviously, and also they'll be happily surprised by a great story. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Win-win.
Everyone wins.
Now, speaking about Steam and digital distribution, as someone who designed games back in the days of retail, what are your thoughts on how sort of like the digital distribution revolution has taken place over the last decade?
Well, you know, I think it's great, but I mean, I'm like a heavy user of ebooks and, mm-hmm. you know, instant video. And I mean, you know, I just don't see it. I don't have a lot of use for physical stuff anymore.
Yeah.
So I get all my games digitally.
Okay.
Because you have space too. Don't forget.
Mm-hmm.
So looking like a border.
Yeah.
You can actually just have everything in one device, which I love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, going back to Kickstarter, another challenge that we've seen with developers moving to crowdfunding is knowing when to actually pitch a Kickstarter campaign. We've seen some developers go for, as just as saying, I want to make a game, to some guy saying, we have a complete demo, our game's in beta, and now we're putting in a Kickstarter. When designing Mobius or coming up with the idea, what was the decision or the point that you said, okay, let's go to Kickstarter and try to get this funded?
Well, like I said, I mean, we didn't really do it the right way. And if I were to do it again, I would have, you know, some concept art and a demo and a really specific concept and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when we did our first Kickstarter in like March 2012,
mm-hmm.
it was just like, okay, we're going to create an adventure game studio and,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're going to make adventure games. And mm-hmm. here's three things, you know, which of these adventure games do you want to see us do first? So we, you know, Mobius was very high level at that point. We didn't, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think I ended up like basically paying somebody to make a piece of concept art for the Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we didn't have much of it when we started out.
And speaking about the Kickstarter, you said it was sort of a little bit too complicated. I noticed on one of the things about the campaign. You mentioned about how you're also doing, you're going to do Mystery Game X on there. What was that like concept? Or where did that idea come from?
Well, the idea that we had, because my husband and I moved to a farm in 2011, and we were really, really into the whole organic local source movement and all of that. And so we thought it would be cute to do, like, they have, CSA is where you basically subscribe to a farm and you get a box of produce once a week for the whole season.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought it would be cute to have a CSG, community supported gaming, where basically people in our Kickstarter are subscribing to the studio and then they get all the games that we do,
mm-hmm.
which is, cute, but it's like, if you only do one game, this is not much of a concept. So we were hoping to get at least two games. And while we were doing our Kickstarter, we were contacted by a publisher and we ended up signing a deal to do this other game, which would be funded through them.
Mm-hmm.
And we, we sort of worked it out that we could give that game to our backers. So,
okay.
That was, but that was Mr. Game X. They didn't want to announce it yet. So
okay.
It was sort of like, we have this other game we're going to give you, but we can't quite tell you what it is yet.
Mm-hmm. I guess one last question for me regarding Kickstarter then is, as we said, Kickstarter has changed over the last 2 years. We're seeing a lot more projects fail. We're seeing people, becoming a little bit more critical over what projects they'll pledge to, what they're expecting from the actual pledge itself. So my question for you, Jay, and this is one that I like to ask any developer comes on, is do you think that Kickstarter or crowdfunding in general is a sustainable model for game development? Or do you think that things may change over the next year or years?
I think it'll continue to evolve. I mean, it has changed a lot. It was really a very new thing.
Yeah.
A couple years ago. So, I think that people are and will continue to get more discerning, and it has to be a project that they really want. But I mean, the concept of it is so strong, that you can fund a game, an indie developer can fund a game through the people who want to buy it, versus a publisher.
Yeah.
And it's just opening up the door to so many different kinds of games that a traditional publisher would never fund. So, I would hope that it doesn't go away entirely. I think it will, become more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Ken, do you have any more Kickstarter-related questions?
Nope. Why don't we talk about the game?
All right. In that case, we'll move on to our final part for the podcast, and that is talking about Mobius itself. So, Jane, I guess the first question then is, for people who have been following it, could you tell us a little bit about the story of Mobius, ignoring, any spoiler-related stuff?
Yeah, so it's a mystery thriller,
mm-hmm.
And the main mystery plot line has to do with, it's very sort of James Bond meets Matrix and The Fringe, the main character, Malachi, is an antiques dealer, antiquities analysis, so he's got like an IQ of 175, and he's got a photographic memory, and he's just incredibly brilliant, and really not, and initially, not a very nice person,
mm-hmm.
but what he does is he travels around the world and he'll evaluate antiques and antiquities that people are trying to sell for millions of dollars, and he'll tell the potential buyer,
mm-hmm.
if it's worth it or if it's not, if it's a fake or whatever. But he, very early on in the game, he's hired by this secretive government agency to sort of use his knowledge of history to mm-hmm. look over the life of this young woman who was murdered in Venice and see if she reminds of him of any famous person in history.
Mm-hmm.
So from then on, the plot just kind of goes into this, like, he's trying to figure out what theory they're working with, and every chapter, it's sort of like an onion plot, where every chapter you get mm-hmm. more into the complexities of this mystery and what's really going on, and has this whole sort of alternate theory of space and time, and
okay.
So it's sort of a, like I said, sort of a Matrix-like thriller, but, there's also a really heavy relationship subplot in the game that mm-hmm. has been very popular with our beta testers, and I think it's probably the thing people will like the most about the game, even above the actual mystery plotline.
Cool. Now, you mentioned earlier that Mobius is aiming more towards classic Avenger game design, so there will be an inventory system, and there will be a greater focus on puzzles compared to what we've seen with other modern adventure games, correct?
Definitely, the recent Telltale stuff, there's more puzzles in it mm-hmm. than that.
Okay. Now, one thing that I found interesting that you mentioned on the Kickstarter, and you sort of brought this up earlier, is how the game has, two difficulty settings. One for the casual adventure game fan, and one for, the older school fan base. Could you talk a little bit about what those two difficulty settings are?
We don't really have that anymore. The most concept that we had during Kickstarter, but we've since abandoned it. You know, we're just trying to take the approach of, I mean, there is a sort of a verb wheel so that when you tap on a hotspot, you know, you might get multiple things you can try to do with that. But it's, you know, it's sort of slimmed down so that it's not, you know, you don't have to try six different things on every item. And so we've sort of ended up with more of a middle ground approach on that.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the main character, at the beginning of the game at least, he's a very unlikable character and stuff like that. And I'm wondering, as a writer, when you're coming up with these stories, or when you're reading or watching something, do you like narration with a character who is unlikable, someone that you just cannot mesh with, or do you like someone who the audience can really support or really rally behind?
Well, I think unlikable is the wrong word. Okay. I mean, the word really is extreme.
Okay.
I like to write extreme characters because, you know, I mean, if you're writing, you know, an average Joe, it's just boring. I mean, it's, you know, it's boring to write the dialogue, you know, and I think it's boring to play. I mean, you know, like Gabriel Knight, for example, is a character that is very extreme. You know, he's always flirting. He's kind of a womanizer. He's very sarcastic. So I prefer to have a main character that has a lot of, you know, a sort of extreme personality like that. And Malachi is like that. He's just very sort of witty and sarcastic and more like a house type character, which to me is very likable because I like those kinds of characters.
And also, that's good too because it always makes them more memorable, right?
Yeah, and it's more fun to do the dialogue. It's like, usually, like with Malachi, you know, when you have a chance to respond to somebody, you can either be sort of nice or you can be like really, you know, say something really annoying. And it's a lot more fun to be annoying, you know?
People remember those lines more than the Boy Scout ones.
That's
right.
Now, you mentioned earlier how you originally started out to have more action or QTE segments in Mobius, and you sort of dial that down. Does the game still have like action segments in it, or is it strictly puzzle and narration now?
There's a little bit, but there's actually, you know, the storyline itself has a lot of action in it, and a lot of it occurs during cutscenes. You know, there's several places where the main character is attacked, and there's a fight sequence, but there's not, you know, you don't actually have to real-time fight in the game.
Okay,
that's a good thing, by the way, because. The worst part about Dreamfall was the real-time combat. I was like, oh, this is a game that did not need this.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, if you're looking at, like, we're trying to really appeal to women as much as male gamers. And I just think, you know, you want to, if somebody really is interested in a combat game, then they should be playing a combat game, you know? This is definitely not that, so...
Yeah, well, you know, the mechanics have to complement the story, too, right? Like, if example, that combat section in Dreamfall, there's other ways to show the action without actually having you to mash and hit characters yourself, because that combat system is very underdeveloped, and that's also, like, at the beginning of, like 3D stuff. Well, not really the beginning, but it was fairly poorly done, because everyone had the same combat pose, and it just felt unnatural, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are games that are so good at that, like, why would you try to compete with that, you know? Why would you try to... That's not what your whole game is about.
Yeah, I mean, your point is to show, like, exhilaration and action and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You can do that through cutscenes or other methods other than having a really, really bad underdeveloped combat system.
Yep. Now, you mentioned a few seconds ago regarding having the player be able to choose different responses to conversations and such. Do they have, like, an impact on the gameplay? Like, if you say something wrong in this situation, the story will change? Or is it mostly for, like, flavor text?
We do both. I mean, like I said, there are several places in the game where, you know, there really are multiple paths. But, you know, we don't sustain that all the way through to the end because it's, you know, number one, we didn't have the budget to have, you know, three times the gameplay.
Yeah.
But also there just really is a, you know, there is a really strong, specific narrative thread in the game. But, yeah, there's definitely, and there are places where, you know, Malachi has this special ability to analyze objects. So you can analyze the people that you meet in the game, and that will often change the dialogue. For example, you know, if you go into this analyze puzzle with this little old lady, you might figure out from the calluses on her fingers and, you know, the way she does her hair that she's a retired music teacher. So then the dialogue with her, you know, might have to do more with what she heard versus what she saw.
Okay.
So there's stuff like that that affects, And then if you, you know, if you insult somebody too much, then you're just not going to get the information that you need. So then you have to do something to apologize. And but there are places where there are multiple paths too.
In that case, does Mobius have a sense of replayability to it, or will the story change enough to warrant multiple game playthroughs, or is this more like a one-time story? Once you've played it, you can, you know, shelve it for a while.
There are a few places where you know, like a couple of chapters where you might want to go back and take a different path through the chapter, because there are different things to see. But overall, you know, there is one ending and one main narrative path through.
Okay. Do you see Mobius as being developed more as a series going on, or do you see this more as a one-time game or experience?
It's definitely set up as a series. Okay. This is basically a pilot episode, setting up, you know, the main two characters and their relationship.
Now, I'm not sure if this will be considered a spoiler or not, but do you have an idea what, like, the general play time or the length of the game will be for most people who are playing it?
I think it's around 15 hours.
Okay.
It's a pretty long game. I mean,
That's interesting, because we saw recently when Double Fine released Broken Age, they were really aiming for like a 6 to 8 hour experience, which was then split into two. And I think that's an interesting part, as we talked about earlier with the pacing of adventure game. It is a bit different in the sense that you're trying to tell the story, but at the same time you're weaving these puzzles into it or not. And I guess that brings me to another question, Dane. Do you prefer games that are more on the longer end of the scale, or those that maybe you could beat in 2 to 3 hours?
I prefer a longer experience.
Mm-hmm.
There's benefits to the shorter and longer experience. The longer experience, you're spending more time with these characters. You have more chance to kind of develop and make those interconnected relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the benefit of having, especially an adventure game, all kind of series.
Yeah.
Because I always feel that a 2 hour adventure episode just leaves me too hungry for more. I can't take it.
Yeah, and especially if you're trying to build a narrative around that, you really need to give these characters and this experience some time to grow. If you just cut it off after like an hour or 2 hours, it really starts, I think, to become segmented. It doesn't feel as grand or as big as it should be.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, when I write a story, it's like it would be hard for me to write like that, because I think, you know, like, if you think about any of the Gabriel Knight games or Grey Matter, it's just, you know, there is an arc of story, and, you know, it's something that if you're going to do character development, and even with a mystery, you know, that needs time to grow.
Yeah.
You know, if it's just like solved within the first half an hour, it's not much of a mystery, you know.
Mhm.
Yeah. It wouldn't be much of that wouldn't be much of a grand adventure, now would it?
Mhm. Okay. I guess one other question, this is somewhat of a tangent. You mentioned earlier that you like to write mystery types stories and narrative. I was just wondering, have you ever looked at creating like an actual horror game or some kind of horror narrative?
Well, there is a lot, you know, Gabriel Knight 1 was really written to be a very scary game, and, you know, there is a lot of horror in the Gabriel Knight franchise. I mean, it's basically a supernatural witch hunter kind of story. Yeah, I mean, something like a zombie, probably not.
Mm-hmm. I think in that case, I'm just about out of questions. Ken, do you have any other questions regarding Mobius?
Actually, I have questions about some Kickstarters that are similar to Mobius.
Okay.
Oh, so did you hear about the new Tex Murphy game that just came out?
I saw a trailer of it probably 4 or 5 months ago that looked really interesting, but I haven't seen it since it came out.
Did you ever think about with your Kickstarter for your game? Mobius, sorry, I almost said Morpheus. I was like, better not say Morpheus. Mobius. Do you ever think about doing it in FMV style? Was that ever thrown around as a real idea?
Not for Mobius, no. I mean, I would like to do another FMV game, but it was a totally different concept that we discussed for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I brought Tex Murphy, because they actually brought the FMV back. So they'll be like one of the only FMV games that exist in this current age of games.
Well, I'm interested to see how it does, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's already succeeded, and it's already it's going to be actually on sale very soon.
I'm curious to see what the actual reception is going to be for
that. Yeah, that's what I mean. I wonder how well it's going to sell and what the critics will think of it. I mean, I would like it if FFP came back. thing is that what I'm really interested in, like, moving forward is I'm really interested in putting in more romance and eroticism in games, and, you know, and I don't mean that from a pink perspective, you know, total, you know.
Yeah, we understand. Yeah.
You know, busts and the guys on the jacket cover kind of thing. But just, you know, to have more of that, you know, more of that in the game, you know, which probably has a different plot line. Like, yeah. I could go there, but you know, I mean, there was some of that in the Gabriel Knight series, and people really love that. And I just think that that's something that in general the game industry doesn't have enough of. So you know, hot men and more sensuality, and it's hard to do that. I mean, like, because I was thinking a really good, you know, if you really really were going to go for that, you'd almost need to do FMV, because it's very hard to, you know, make 3D characters pull off eroticism, but I could be wrong.
Listen, if you were to say, hi, I'm the creator of the Gabriel Knight series, and I want to do an FMV game, people just throw money at you. Just throw it at you. They're like, yes, we want an FMV game. Do it. Go for it.
You really think so?
Definitely, because it's so niche. And you have fans, like, you have rabid fans. So if you were to do that, and it's your most popular one, they would probably go all nuts for it.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I would definitely look to see how Tex Murphy does, because as we said, FMV, I mean, I remember, I think you probably remember too, how it was sort of like this very hokey thing in the 90s. I just talked about an FMV game called Immercenary. It had all FMV sequences, and back then it was just very eerie to watch those types of games. And then game technology improved, and now we got the massive 3D engine and stuff like that. So it'll be interesting, really, to see if people will respond favorably to watching live actors talk about all kinds of crazy stuff. Because we did see that with the Command & Conquer series. They sort of held that torch for as long as they could.
Well, I think that's why it was Tex Murphy was so successful. Not just because of the franchise and people's nostalgia for it, but because we haven't seen a game like that for like 15 years. So, exactly.
Yeah, I hope it does really well, because I would like to do another FMV game at some point, and we'll see.
I feel like you'd easily get the initial funding, but the thing is, that's the benefit of Kickstarter. You already get a fan base that's already going to not only, you know, buy your game, but spread the word.
Yeah.
So that's the great thing about Kickstarter, except for their demands and updates that you have to do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it definitely helps make a game much more visible, which hopefully will help Mobius out.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, Mobius is releasing in just like 14 days, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is, though, what a lot of companies sink their money into new IPs is all marketing. All this money goes into marketing, and sometimes it doesn't even work, and they're spending millions of dollars.
Yeah, it is scary.
But you already have a base. You already have people that are already funded to you, and then obviously they will sing its praises too. So either way, you know, it'll benefit you as long as you haven't, you know, gone over a certain cost.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one great thing Kickstarter offers over traditional publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it really did help us get our studio name out there, you know, very quickly.
And then you'd be like, guess what, guys? We're making an FMV game too. Money! Yeah, and just random. The people that we missed also did Kickstarter too for a game called Abduction.
Is that still, like, working on that? Like, did that succeed?
It succeeded.
Okay.
You know why I funded it? Mm. Oculus Rift support.
Oh.
Now, this actually might lead me to a question for you. You know what the Oculus Rift is?
I don't.
Oh.
It is the virtual reality head-mounted display. Like, you pretty much put yourself in the game. But the reason this technology works is it has a much wider field of vision and a really low latency. So when you move your head, it's 1-to-1. So you feel like you're in a location.
Wow, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, you know, that's a big push that's going on right now. And that's just why Josh brought up earlier that Facebook bought the company that made the device, which is why I groaned earlier, because I'm still kind of reeling from that. I'm actually
that was always sort of my, you know, ultimate fantasy as a, you know, in terms of adventure game, was a holodeck kind of thing where you were actually totally immersed in the game and you could actually open a door and, you know,
actually
have a pit bull charging towards you, you know.
Well, that's the amazing thing now, though, because the Oculus Rift got so popular, other companies are releasing their own versions of the head-mounted display, and a bunch of third-party companies are creating stuff for it, like wireless controllers or hand controllers or a Omni treadmill, which allows you to run in one place, you know, defeating that I'm going to run into a wall problem.
That's cool.
So you might be able to do that in the next probably the next year. You could probably create a game and make through that experience.
Wow.
Super neat.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I guess the only thing that doesn't factor in, at least in my experience, since I do development on it, is the concept of wind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And heat and touch. Like, that's not touches. Touches, they're working on it, but like heat is another problem too. Because you go into an environment, you go into a place, and it needs to be some sort of feeling of that, or you won't really, you kind of feel like you're sucked out of it because you're in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
But sorry.
Yeah.
Just something I wanted to throw out there.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I do have an ancillary question to all this in a second, if we're done.
I think we're just about ready to wrap up.
Yeah.
then this is the question that I have for you. So I am making an Oculus Rift adventure game, right? And the weird thing is that the main character is a girl. Do you think that would pose, and this is as an experience, do you think that would pose a problem for male players being placed in a girl's body in first person? Or do you think there would be transgender issues that would arise from it?
Gosh, you're asking the wrong person.
This is a really wild question, which is why I want to bring it up.
I mean, I would suspect that if I pitched something like that at a company, like a big company, that's exactly what I would hear from PR and marketing. Because I've had people concerned about that before, even mm-hmm. when it was just like a first-person, you know, game with a female character.
Right.
So, I mean, but, you know, I've never been a person who really liked rules like that. I mean, you know, if a game is great, a game is great. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a big believer in, you know, policing creativity like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I also had some feedback, too, from somebody that I thought it was very offensive. They said to me that because I'm a guy, I can't write a female character. How do you feel about statements like that when people talk about you and your writing?
Well, interestingly enough, at GDC, I had this journalist who sort of basically was like, why, you know, we need more strong female characters in the gaming world, and you're one of the best-known female designers. Why don't you write female characters? Because I had just shown him Mobius, which the main character is male, and the other main character is male. And it's like, I really didn't know what to say at the time other than, you know, I have done. I mean, Grey Matter had a female lead, and Grace is obviously a strong character, but I just feel more comfortable writing guys. And, you know, then later I was thinking about it. It was like, no, I like to write hot guys. You know, it's like, I don't want to write me. I want to write my fantasy, you know, and that's like, and women love Gabriel Knight, you know, I mean, women like to play those games. So it's more like I'm writing a woman's fantasy in a male character, sexualizing a male character, if you will. So, I mean, to me, that's just more interesting. And you know, and I almost find it kind of insulting, the idea of, like, why don't you give a girl a role model? It's like, why, you know, I don't need a fucking role model. You know, I know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do guys need a role model? You know, it's like, mm-hmm. no, you know, I mean, so, mm-hmm. yeah.
That's actually a great response. It reminds me of, there was this film called Better Luck Tomorrow, and it was an all-Asian cast. And there was this, you know, it was, I guess, at a film festival, and there were some guy, like, stubbed up, be like, you guys are reinforcing Asian stereotypes, and you guys should be role model because you're an all-Asian cast, and you should say all these things. And then Roger Ebert stood up and be like, no, they're filmmakers, they have their own vision, they can make anything they want to, and they don't have to be tethered to these standards.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great response.
Yeah.
So
I say, if you want to write a girl, write it, you know, write it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know?
Yeah, exactly. If I feel like I have a good story to tell, and I have a preference for the girl the character to be a girl, like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think there's any sort of tether that should be placed upon me just because of gender.
No, I mean, because if you went with that, it'd be like you'd have to write, you know, a story that is set in Philadelphia, and it's, you know, I mean, like, you know, that's why we have imagination, you know.
Slippery slope. Like, well, okay, I can't write different races, different religions. Like, there's a lot of limited, you know, like, I could just go on different hair color. It has to be the same hair color.
Yeah, good story should be a good story. It doesn't have to be locked into specific genders or specific situations.
Right, and I wonder if they're trying to say, like, well, you need to reinforce stereotypes too, so make sure you do that. Like, no, don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I think with that, we can start wrapping things up. Ken, do you have any final questions at all?
Nope.
In that case, before we end things, Jane, do you have anything you would like to say to the fans or any final thoughts you would like to talk to us about?
Nothing special, just, you know, Mobius is about to come out, and we're also working on a remake of GK1, so
cool.
You know, stay tuned.
Oh, remake of GK1? Darn, we should have not said first. So everyone, GK1's being redone. Check it out.
You knew that, didn't you?
Yeah.
Josh knew that. I didn't.
I didn't. I was just showing Ken the original one last night on goodoldgames.com.
Josh is the prepared one. I am the unprepared one.
Yeah, we have a website for it. It's GabrielKnight20th.com.
Cool. I'll make sure to put that in the podcast notes as well. And do you have the specific date for Mobius as well?
April 15th.
Awesome. And is that going to be available strictly from, like, digital sites like Steam? Will it be from your own website? Or, like, what platforms will it be available on?
It's on Steam, GOG, Game Boomers, probably Amazon, and also the Phoenix Online Store.
Cool. All right. So I think with that, we can end things for this week's cast. Jane, it was a pleasure to talk to you, and I can't wait to try out Mobius in the next few weeks.
Well, let me know what you think.
Hopefully we can have you back on at some point, either to talk more about Avenger design, or maybe more about women in the game industry.
Sure, anytime.
Awesome. And Ken, as always, it was great to have you on as well.
No problem.
So with that, we're going to end things for the Perceptive Podcast this week. As always, if you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, either by being a future podcast guest or writing a guest piece for the site, feel free to send me an email. You can find all the information, guidelines, and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. So with that said, thank you for listening to the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great weekend. We will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.